Hey, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast on rights and liberties. This is Jenny, glad to be joining you again. And in today's episode, we're going to talk about the first part of the First Amendment, aka your freedom of religion. So in this episode, we're going to lay out the content of that section of the First Amendment. It's not very long, but it does have some important elements that we need to separate out, particularly the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. And then we need to get into the cases. What does the case law, or the history of Supreme Court decisions, that is, tell us about where we stand in terms of the status of freedom of religion, where we are at in terms of tests on things like the Establishment Clause, and where do we line up today? What questions will the justices ask in relation to cases on this topic? Quick note, if you haven't done so already, please go ahead and make your way to the Week 4 Roadmap page, and let's open up those slides. I generally recommend opening up the PDF copy while you're listening to the podcast, as it's easier to just kind of scroll through the big version of those slides. All right, without any further ado, let's do this. So I am looking here at slide 3, where we get into the actual text of the First Amendment. And the first portion reads, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." Now, this would seem to make pretty clear. No laws about religion, nothing to push religion, nothing to hinder religion. But the fact of the matter is, states can absolutely pass laws that restrict religious activities, only if those laws have a valid non-religious purpose and when they have a good reason to do so. So non-religious, by the way, is the same as the word secular. Secular means non-religious. So when you hear me use that term in this discussion, it just means it is not religious or not religiously focused. It is totally separate from that. Okay, so in noting that governments can pass limitations on religious activities so long as they have a non-religious purpose and when they have a compelling interest, this is still going to leave wide open a whole lot of religious practices that people may find hard to stomach. Animal sacrifice, protected by the Constitution. Use of illegal drugs in religious rituals, protected by the Constitution, although maybe you can't get unemployment benefits if you lose your job because of that. Things said or done that may be patently offensive to most human beings, like, let's say, protesting at someone's funeral. Covered by the Constitution. It's all going to be pretty okay in the name of religion, including even discriminatory practices, but we do tend to draw a line when it comes to violence against people, right? No human sacrifice. That might have been something the Aztecs and the Mayans and the Chinese and the Egyptians and other cultures did as part of religious ritual. That's not going to be protected. And there's good reasons not to protect that practice, and those reasons certainly aren't just about religion. So something like human sacrifice, that's not going to be okay. That's going to qualify as homicide. You're not going to be allowed to do that as part of your free exercise of religion. Now, there's two key components here. The Establishment Clause, the first portion of the amendment, and the Free Exercise Clause, the second kind of, you know, substantively focused portion of the wording. The Establishment Clause essentially is about the separation between church and state that is initially articulated probably most clearly by Thomas Jefferson in his ratification discussions and debates with respect to even the state of Virginia, right? He's talking about that in the debates on ratification, calling for a wall of separation between church and state. And that wall is fundamentally what we think of as part of the Establishment Clause. Government cannot create or promote a specific church or a specific religious approach, set of religious beliefs, anything like that. Likewise, the Constitution is basically going to, as part of the Establishment Clause, not allow the government to hinder that. But we're going to see that more in terms of what's called the Free Exercise Clause. So government should not interfere with a person who is practicing their religious actions or beliefs, again, subject to some limits. But this is really corresponding to the other side of the Establishment Clause. The government can't promote a specific religion, but it also can't prohibit one. It may sound weird to put this out there, but honestly, there are very few cases related to freedom of religion in comparison with, let's say, freedom of speech, which is our topic for the next time. This doesn't have that many cases, mostly because we haven't really had that many challenges around separation between government and church or government and religion, although of late, that's really been upended. We've seen a lot of cases, in particular, around schools and what can schools require, what can schools allow, what is, you know, the boundaries between, let's say, children engaging in prayer or moments of silence. What is it that we can fund for schools? Where can we direct taxpayer money? Particularly when we have certain principles or doctrines like separation of church and state. So the early cases that are pretty foundational, as in they kind of set up where we go in the future. The first of these that I would call out is in 1947, Everson versus Board of Education, where we're dealing with money and whether money coming from taxpayers can be used to support things like busing. We're going to talk a bit more about the case facts in a minute, but this case is really important in terms of it gives some criteria for assessing whether a law or a practice is in violation of the Establishment Clause. And those three criteria, which become the Lemon Test, which is eventually dismissed by the Supreme Court and called dead, are number one, does the law have a secular purpose, meaning non-religious? Number two, does the law neither advance nor hinder a religion? And number three, does the law not result in excessive entanglement between the government and religious institutions? So again, this becomes what the test is in 1971 when we get Lemon v. Kurtzman. But before that point in time, we're still using these standards and these questions to figure out, well, where do we draw the line? Particularly for schools and taxpayer funding and religion, specifically religious schools. In 1961, the Supreme Court made a decision in the case Braunfeld v. Brown, where Braunfeld is an Orthodox Jew. He's not allowed to work on Saturdays per his religion, and he's living in Pennsylvania, which has what is called a blue law. Now, a blue law is essentially a law passed by the state or the government that restricts certain activities or makes them outright illegal on specific days of the week, like Sundays, or on religious holidays. So you can't sell alcohol. You can't have a business that's open. This is generally tied to Sunday for most of the blue laws that were in existence because of the general historical religious origins of the United States. We are heavily Christian, a lot of Protestantism, and so blue laws were often intended to preserve the Sabbath as a day of rest. And that meant Sundays, you couldn't do any of these things. So clearly, Braunfeld is wanting his store to be open for services on Sundays. And he needs the store to be open for economic reasons, but he's now prohibited from having it open on Saturday due to his religion, his religious practices and beliefs, and then he's prohibited on Sunday because of state law. So when the court gets this case, the question is essentially, did this blue law violate free exercise of religious beliefs? And because it's a free exercise question, we're not talking about whether obviously there's an establishment issue here. The freedom to hold certain beliefs may be protected, but the freedom to act or do things like open your store, that's allowed to be governed by government restrictions. So the blue law may have an indirect burden, as we've highlighted here. that's not going to be enough. Indirect burdens aren't going to violate the free exercise of religion. So there's this free exercise test that we get tied in here. Laws restricting actual practice could be valid if they are serving an important purpose and they're the least restrictive means to achieve that purpose. Take note of that wording. We are going to see this again, particularly when it comes to speech. So, setting aside these foundational cases, there are several cases I want us to look at for this week. And a lot of this conversation is actually going to be me inviting you to look over the case briefs that are posted on the Week 4 Roadmap page. If you scroll down to the bottom of that page, there will be a section on case briefs, and I will have drafted these for you. These are my shorthand versions of explaining the case facts, the legal question, the majority opinions, and then any concurring or dissenting opinions that were written for that case. So let's work our way back to the beginning. And if we're focusing on the Establishment Clause, I want us to know a little bit more about the Everson case. Now in Everson, we're in New Jersey and school boards are creating contracts for busing, right? Busing is a pretty common method of getting kids to school, at least, you know, through the 1980s and 1990s. I'm not sure how common it is today, but in New Jersey at the time, the board who's in charge in Ewing Township says, we're going to reimburse parents for sending their kids to either a non-religious school or a religious school with this bus system. And we're offering it to both groups. We are not discriminating on religion. We're just simply saying either group can use the bus. And so Everson files this suit and says, well, this is a violation of taxpayer money being used to support religion. So we're exceeding the separation of church and state. We don't have it anymore. The decision in the case was that the law was neutral because it didn't advance or hinder religion, right? It didn't prevent anyone from attending a religious school. It didn't necessarily make it more plausible that they would. It's simply available as a benefit to either secular schools or non-secular schools. And because we don't discriminate, we're okay here. We're in a fine space. The concept of neutrality, by the way, is also going to be, again, very important when it comes to freedom of speech. So keep your eyes open for any questions around this. This notion of neutrality, that we aren't pushing for something or holding something back, that's a big question and a big principle, I would say, that the Supreme Court focuses on, especially when they're creating tests related to any number of rights. The dissenters in Everson said, look, number one, the facts don't match what the court is arguing here. And it's pretty clear, according to the framers, that this would not be allowed. This quote of not even three pence was to be taken from citizens for the purpose of overlap between church and state. Those aren't just the words of Jefferson. They're pulling in Madison here. What method of interpretation are we talking about? As in, thinking about the majority decision, how does it seem that they are approaching this issue or question? And how do the dissenters seem to be approaching the question? What methods can you see reflected just in the limited wording you see here, if any? And then I want you to keep on the lookout as we make progress through additional cases. Do you see those methods of interpretation continuing, or do we see other options coming into the discussion? Rolling right along, we move from 1947 to 1963. Remember, we are in the era now of civil rights movement. We are looking down like the timeline of Brown v. Board of Education. So we are dealing with a lot going on socially. And in this case, School District of Abington v. Shemp in 1963, you've got a challenge coming from a family that is Unitarian Universalist, okay? And this kid, Ellery Shemp, who is actually pictured on the left, is essentially being told in school that he has to read the Bible, right? He's in a Pennsylvania school, and this is not gonna be okay necessarily with his father, Edward Shemp. At the same time that the Supreme Court is considering the case out of Pennsylvania, they're also looking at a law or a school board rule, excuse me, that comes from Baltimore, which says we're not just going to read the Bible, we're going to say the Lord's Prayer every day in school. And what the Supreme Court does here is they actually do take that test that we saw in Everson and we pretty simply apply it, right? So the first question that really gets asked here in this case is, does the law advance or hinder a religion, right? We answer that question, well, it's requiring religious actions. In fact, it's mandating them. So if that's the case, then we have a violation here. We are not able to say that this respects the Establishment Clause and the limits that should be placed upon the government and the schools. So no, this is not constitutional. You're not going to be able to insist on the Lord's Prayer or the reading of the Bible. And we're not talking about reading of the Bible, by the way, in the context of a religion class. We're just talking about it in an elementary school. So we're utilizing this reading of the Bible probably more as life lessons or just opening of the classroom day, so to speak. In the Abington case, we get a concurring opinion, which basically says, guess what? We aren't going to get an answer from the founding fathers. There's a lot of conflicting opinions there. We have more diversity now than there was back then. And public schools may be intended to foster a civic heritage, but that can't be theistic nor atheistic. So we're leaning more in towards this religious direction with that heritage or what we're trying to build up as part of, you know, a student's ideal behavior or thought pattern. That's really what we're trying to build here is, you know, some sort of civic involvement. But doing so through biblical reading and through prayer, that's going to be a step too far for this court. Now, the dissenters point out, wait a minute, we have all sorts of instances where there is religion in government. Let's say chaplains for the armed services. We're literally paying chaplains who are religious officials to provide services in the military. So perhaps we should, let's say, allow school boards a little more leniency and give them some different options to respond to different religious opinions while still giving them the space to do so constitutionally. So this is, again, a question of, well, what methods of interpretation do you see in these decision descriptions? Are you seeing originalism? Are you seeing consequentialism? Are you seeing, I don't know, precedent? Are they referring to any precedents here? Or does it seem kind of like they're maybe going on their own thought patterns? And if they are, what would that tie into for methods of interpretation, particularly in this case? Following the Abington case in 1963, the next major case we're going to look at is Lemon v. Kurtzman. And at this point, I would invite you to go ahead and open up the PDF file, which is the case brief for Lemon v. Kurtzman. And I want to walk you a little bit through how a case brief looks. So at the top, you have the title of the case. The title of the case is always going to be the first party wants the decision that was made before to be overturned or overruled, basically tell them they got it wrong. And the second name in the parties is the group that won the first time or the person that won the first time who's going to want the first that last decision to be upheld or kept in place. So Lemon is not happy with where we've been before from any previous courts, the district court or the court of appeals. And what Lemon is arguing in this case is that we have a problem with taxpayer money from Pennsylvania being involved again, going towards something that is going to facilitate religious schools. Now, the law says we can pay teachers and we can pay for classroom materials that are used in either religious schools or non-religious schools, but the money is going to go towards secular non-religious topics, okay? So this could be like U.S. history or English or math. In short, the law is allowing for non-religious topics being taught by teachers or non-religious classroom materials being used in a religiously affiliated school, okay? So it's not a secular school, it's a religious school. And Lemon files this suit against the superintendent and says, nope, this is beyond church and state. Like, there's no separation here. We need separation. And part of this case becomes another decision related to Rhode Island, because Rhode Island has a situation where they're paying teachers to offer secular classes in religious schools. Not that different, right? We're still paying teachers in religious schools to teach non-religious topics. Lemon is the first time we get the full articulation and set of three questions that become what is known as the Lemon Test. Now, you've already seen these with Everson, but do the laws being considered have a secular, aka non-religious purpose? Number two, is the primary effect of the law to push for or restrict religion? And number three, do the laws lead to excessive entanglement between the government and religion? And what the majority decides in this case is they do say that Lemon's right. There is a problem here. Although the laws and this first question are fine, the laws are clearly not about religious topics. So obviously there's a secular purpose. We're not teaching religious stuff. There's a problem that's going to emerge in terms of excessive entanglement. Now, you're going to notice something if you think about the way I said the questions versus the way I just responded to them. I didn't answer question number two about whether the primary effect was to push for or restrict religion. And the reason I didn't answer that is because the court didn't. So although they've come up with this test, we're also seeing sometimes they get away from the test and they don't really follow the questions in the order that they've specified. Okay, let's go back to looking at that brief, and I want you to see a few points about the structure before I move into our next case. So, following the details of the case, we had that breakdown in the legal questions, and then we have the majority decision. For each case brief that I will write up and make available to you for this class, you will see a vote, and you will see which side won the case. So it's 8-1 in favor of Lemon, meaning one justice voted for Pennsylvania under the name of Kurtzman here. But most of them, 8 out of the 9 to be specific and exact, voted for Lemon. And you can see the overall decision is summarized after that. Now, what I intend to do with any case brief is to line up the description of the decision with the legal questions. So there's 3 legal questions in this case brief, and there's 3 bullets under the majority decision. Each bullet lines up to the question above. So the first bullet is for question number 1, the second bullet is for question number 2, and the third bullet is for question number 3. And for question number 3, they did a lot more examination and explanation, so I've broken that down even a little bit more with the subsections under the majority decision. If you scroll to page 2, you are going to see 2 additional sections. One for concurring opinions, which are the opinions where a justice says, yep, I agree with the overall decision, but I have a different reason. And then the dissenting opinions, which is, I don't agree with the overall decision, and here's my reasons why. In the Lemon v. Kurtzman case, we didn't have any concurring opinions. All 8 of the justices who voted in favor liked the reasoning that was given for the majority opinion. But Justice White offers his dissenting opinion where he says, look, precedent has noted that religious schools don't just serve religious functions. They also have secular functions, excuse me. And the laws here are clear. Just because a student's getting an education at a religious school doesn't mean that the state shouldn't protect that right. And also it doesn't mean that we're furthering or advancing any sort of religious purpose. But his big point is more about the third part of the question, because the justices all agreed that this was not a problem with the law advancing or hindering religion. They had a problem with excessive entanglement. So Justice White says there, the only question where we have a problem is this one, and essentially what you've said with your decision here is that states can have literally nothing to do with religious schools, even if they're doing secular work. And further, there's no proof that there is any sort of crossing over between religion and the secular topics that we're being paid for through these laws. So we really need to actually send this back to the lower courts to find out if that was happening. If it is, then we can just go ahead and rule this unconstitutional. But we haven't actually got that as far as our case facts, and you'll notice that isn't listed in the case facts. Justice White is simply saying, if we don't have that as an actual fact in this case, we need to make that determination first before we say that the laws are unconstitutional. Now, whether you disagree or agree, Justice White has an interesting point here where he's saying, look, if this was truly happening, if we had some sort of crossover between the two, let's say we started to teach math and then somehow we brought in Bible education as part of that conversation, we would definitely have a big problem here. So that is possible, but we don't know that that's what's actually happening. And since the laws as written seem to have a pretty clear direction in terms of not advancing or hindering religion, perhaps we need to really examine what the truth is in terms of this excessive entanglement before we say the laws are unconstitutional. Every case brief that you will see listed for this course, and there's not a huge number of them because they're all my work, not your work, since you're not assigned to do case briefs, well, each one will have this same format. The title and the citation information at the top in a running header, and the breakdown of the case facts or details, the legal questions, the majority decision, and then the explanation of concurring and dissenting opinions. What you might also see with the concurring and dissenting opinions is that I will list how many judges signed on to a dissenting opinion or a concurring opinion and who those justices were. All right, having that structure, I think we can move forward to looking at the cases of Wallace v. Jaffrey regarding whether a moment of silence and voluntary prayer is an acceptable approach to, you know, doing something under the law that relates to school practices, as well as then Zelman v. Simmons Harris, which is somewhat different, right? We're talking in the Zelman v. Simmons Harris case about school vouchers and how we can pass money along to families who then can use that to send their child to a religious school or a secular school. And what's going to be critical in Zelman v. Simmons Harris is this concept of true choice. So please take a moment and go read the case briefs for each of those cases. Again, you can find those listed on the Week 4 Roadmap page at the bottom under the case briefs for this week, and they'll be immediately below the Lemon v. Kurtzman brief. So it's Lemon, then Wallace, then Zelman, and then we have a few more where we get into discussion of the free exercise clause. But for now, just focus on reading Wallace and Zelman, and then send me any questions that you have when you read through those case briefs. Think about, what are they setting up as far as the legal questions? How are they answering those questions, or are they actually answering all of the questions? And then what methods of interpretation do you see in the majority opinion, any concurring opinions, and any dissenting opinions? Right now, as of fall 2025, we have seen a lot of change for the Establishment Clause tests, really the tests that were going to determine whether we have a proper separation of church and state. And that's captured on slides 12 and 13. And I want you to notice how much this has evolved and how much this has changed from the past to today. So if we think about going all the way back to Everson in 1947, the question was really about neutrality. Does the law neither advance nor hinder religion, right? And that case did add more to it, but that's really at the heart of the case. Are we passing laws that don't push for any religious outcomes or don't hold back any religious groups? If it's that structure, we're generally okay constitutionally speaking. Many of these early cases talked about taking an originalist approach where they use the words of, let's say, Jefferson or Madison and this wall of separation between church and state. Some people even get into the not a threepence to be submitted for the, you know, religious causes. I don't go so far as to say that that's the full wording, and certainly that's not the way the Supreme Court has interpreted it, but that's where we begin. And then we move into the Lemon test, where we say not just neutral, right? But we're also going to specify neither hindering nor advancing religion, which at its core is really kind of part and parcel of neutrality. But we're going to tack on this thing with excessive entanglement. If we're going to have to police this heavily from the government side, that's going to be too much. That's going to be a step too far. So we can't allow some sort of situation where we have to do that. Again, thinking here about that Lemon test and saying, what are we going to do? Are we going to have to follow up and make sure that teachers are not bringing in religious subjects when they're teaching a class? How much do we have to investigate and follow up? And really, if we have to do any significant investigation, that's going to be too much. So they revised this in cases that we didn't talk about. The first being Agostini v. Felton, where they said, okay, we're going to kind of mash and merge the Lemon Test. And we're going to talk about not just purpose, but we're also going to think about effects. So in Agostini, it's whether the program results in quote unquote governmental indoctrination of religion, then whether it defines participants by referring to religion. So does it only apply to certain people or groups? And then they keep the last part basically from Lemon as it was written, where we look at excessive entanglement. So the purpose now becomes, is there a government push for indoctrination of religion? And are we looking at specific groups of people, referring to those people as far as their religious beliefs? And then we get to excessive entanglement. Now, Zelman v. Simmons-Harris takes us in a totally different direction because here we're saying, well, okay, as long as there's an element of private choice, well, that's about neutrality, right? The government isn't telling you where to spend the money. It's not making the decision for you. It's saying as long as parents have true private choice, that's neutral. I'd encourage you to read a fair bit with the dissenting opinions in that case because of the fact that they talk so much about this notion of private choice, and not just private choice, but how, well, this may be private choice, but almost 100% of the funding for that program ended up going to religious schools. So think about private choice, but also think about, well, what about the effects now? What are the effects? And would that be crossing the line based on what we have under Agostini v. Felton? But ultimately, all of this is going to be set aside in a case known as Kennedy v. Bremerton, something that we've referenced before in this class. As of the decision in that case, which happened in 2022, the Establishment Clause test that was in place, the Lemon Test, is gone. It's no longer going to be applied to cases, and instead what the court is going to look at are historical practices and understandings. And this has sometimes been referred to as text, history, and tradition. You may read this in different cases, but essentially what the court is saying, well, we're going to look at what the history says, what our practices were in the past, and how we understood those. I find this to be quite vague, so I'm not really sure how we can truly specify what this test looks like, but we do know that Lemon's gone. So the zombie Lemon Test, as it was referred to at times by different Supreme Court justices, is no longer walking around waiting to be taken out. It's not the Walking Dead, it's just straight gone. So with that, let's move into the Free Exercise Clause and some important cases that help us to establish what that clause means and how the Supreme Court has approached it. All right, let's begin that Free Exercise Clause discussion with the case in 1942 of West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett. Okay, so in 1942, pretty standard practice in any school is to require students to do things like salute a flag, say the Pledge of Allegiance, maybe recite portions of the Bible, some sort of reading of that nature. This was really very common. So the picture you see on slide 15 looks kind of like, you know, young children practicing the Nazi salute, but it's actually how children used to salute the flag in the actual classroom setting. So scroll to slide 16, and what you'll see there are the facts of the case, and what we're coming up against here is a student is in a class, or students from a specific family of Jehovah's Witnesses are in a class, and they won't perform the salute to the flag. And it's not because of any reason that has to do with maybe some secular practice, but it's truly because for Jehovah's Witnesses, salutes to a flag are a form of false idol worship, right? And that is definitely going to be something that violates the fundamental religious beliefs of those Jehovah's Witnesses. So these folks are saying, I won't do that. It violates my religious rules and practices. And the school in response says, guess what? We're not just going to send your kids home for not complying. We're going to possibly expel them and send them to a school for criminally active children, these reform schools that exist at the time. And on top of that, we're going to be prosecuting parents who fail to have their students follow this practice. So pretty broad threats from schools towards parents who are saying this is going to violate their religious practice. So we get this question in this case. Does a compulsory flag salute violate the First Amendment? And that's a pretty simplified version of what the actual legal question. Part of the reason I bring this case up and show it to you both in terms of, let's say, the snapshots from Oyer that you're seeing in the slides versus what you can see in the West Virginia v. Barnett case brief is that the question that shows up on Oyer regarding the pretty simplistic version of the compulsory flag salute violating the First Amendment is quite different from the three questions that I have presented to you on the case brief. That case brief is actually much more tied into the full opinion of the Supreme Court in the case. And in that opinion, what they did was they asked, how does the 14th Amendment relate to school boards or boards of education? Are these elements that fall under the state when we consider the 14th Amendment and how it incorporates the states? Question number two is really about, okay, is this something that would constitute a clear and present danger? That may sound just absolutely ridiculous to think about not saluting the flag as that, but that is part of figuring out the boundaries of what kinds of free speech at this time the Congress is allowed to limit. So if you don't salute the flag, is that a clear and present danger that Congress has a duty to protect? And then question number three, if we're thinking about these kind of general goals of national unity and national security, and in the context of the time when we're thinking about World War II and what's going on, let's say even with the practices around Japanese internment camps, this is a really powerful question. In the name of national security, in the Korematsu case, we're actually allowed to deprive citizens of their most basic rights to keep property and to not have, I mean, to actually have due process of law. We simply took people from their homes and we forced them to relocate. So here, are we allowed to pursue national security by mandating simple practices in schools like saluting the flag, maybe even reciting the Pledge of Allegiance? All of these standard things that the school is offering as, well, this is how we build national unity. This is how we build national security. Okay, contrasting those legal questions, it's important to, again, see how Oyer presents a case which is often quite different from what actually appears in the full opinion from the court. I say this because I think Oyer is an excellent tool for you to use. Remember, this is oyez.org, and you can easily look up any of the cases that we're going over this semester and, generally speaking, find a full discussion of the case. Now, that said, it's not going to map perfectly to what the written opinion is because the Oyer summary is just that, a simplified summary that isn't written by the justices themselves, and it's going to be something that truly gives you the 30,000-foot view, often without giving you important details or all of the questions that the court is answering at the time. For this reason, I strongly recommend that you start at Oyer, but then you proceed to at least read what's called the syllabus of any case. Yes, that is the same term we use to describe the plan for any course. You know, the syllabus is what you get at the beginning of the semester. But the syllabus in a court decision lays out a lot of the basic case facts, as well as has this section where it lists what was held in the case. And it's literally the word held, usually in italics, that says, here is what we decided in this specific case. And the syllabus walks through each of the legal questions or legal issues that were addressed. And sometimes it gives really extensive reasoning as to why they came to that answer. So make sure that when you're reading through a case on Oyer, you then go back and read that syllabus as well. Because Oyer is giving you the nuts and bolts and in a way that probably doesn't actually reflect the exact questions the court was considering. And that can really change the framing and our understanding of the case and of the legal issues. So with that said, take a minute. Go read the West Virginia v. Barnett case brief. Look at those three legal questions, the responses to each question that you see there, and then check out both the concurring opinions and the dissenting opinion. Now, the concurring opinions, we have two separate ones here, but you'll notice in the concurring opinion by Black, what I've listed in that concurring opinion is that he was joined by Justice Douglas. So anytime you prepare a case brief like this, and I do recommend them as tools for yourself as you work through each case, it helps to know who was, you know, siding with a specific argument or a specific set of reasons. If you have three people concurring on one set of reasons, that's probably more convincing and more persuasive than maybe when one person presents just their concurring opinion, because that means not everybody agreed with the way that they saw or understood the answer to the legal questions in that case. All right, let's move forward into a case that I don't have briefed called Sherbert v. Verner. And this starts on slide 18. And I want you again to read through the case facts, but this time I want you to focus just on what Oye says. So the Oye case facts and the question are listed on slide 19. And if you can, stop there and ask yourself, if I were a justice, how would I see the facts of this case, and how would I interpret both the First and the 14th Amendments? Remember always when the 14th Amendment is being brought into these cases, that's purely for the reason that we're dealing with the states, or a state law. And in this situation, it is a South Carolina law that she is pushing back against, a law that requires basically no work on Sundays, right? Employers are not allowed to require them, at least, to work on Sundays. And she's not able to work on Saturday because of her religious practices, which is going to make it hard for her to actually get a job in this context. Read the case facts, look at the question, and then I want you to examine the legal reasoning of the court in the decision. Do you agree? And what do you see reflected even in that short and brief discussion? Are you seeing things like consequentialism, originalism? What are they doing? And what do you identify as maybe either elements of one of those methods of interpretation? Or do you start to see the pieces here that resemble something like a test that the court might apply to free exercise, like what they do with the Establishment Clause? When it comes to the Free Exercise Clause, we actually have quite a few cases and a pretty lengthy case history. So what I'm going to encourage you to do with the Employment Division v. Smith case, we've got the slides with Oye and we've got the case brief. Read through both and consider, are we seeing application again of a test? Are we seeing something different, where we're talking about more of a separate method of interpretation that stands apart from a test? And then we're going to get into some very recent decisions, specifically Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission, and then the Kennedy v. Bremerton School District case. Kennedy v. Bremerton is really a groundbreaking case when it comes to legal rights in the United States. So start with Masterpiece Cake Shop, which is originally taking place in 2012, and I want to say that decision comes around in 2013, maybe 2015 actually, once we've gone through the entire process of the cake shop owner being taken to court and basically held accountable for making decisions that he won't serve a gay couple. That is going to be in violation of Colorado's anti-discrimination laws, and this cake shop qualifies as what is known as a public accommodation. In the United States, we have some pretty strict rules around public accommodations. Since we had such a long history of active practices of discrimination based on things like race and ethnicity, we've formulated a whole set of laws that identify when you have a public accommodation, a place that is generally open to the public, such as a restaurant or a business, then it's going to be illegal to discriminate on the basis of an individual's identity. So saying you won't serve a gay couple by making them a wedding cake, but that you'll serve all other couples, is going to be questionable at least in terms of discrimination law. Most people would have said that this would violate the discrimination statutes that we have in place and would constitute a huge problem because, again, we're dealing with a public service and public services cannot be denied based on an individual's identity. But you're going to see that the legal reasoning and the question here is emphasizing some pretty specific elements of the First Amendment and whether we can discriminate based on, let's say, the first portion of this First Amendment, which is about religion. Specifically, does the Free Exercise Clause protect you on some level and in some way when it comes to discrimination that may violate your religious views? As you read through what's on Oyez, and then again, go check out the syllabus for this case, which the link should also be on the Oyez webpage. Look through what are they asking and how are they examining this case? Are they considering some sort of test? Or are they looking at maybe the history? What are they focusing on as far as the wording of the Colorado law? And whether this has some sort of elements of prior tests or whether this looks truly very different. Now, rounding out with the final case for this topic and discussion, it's Kennedy v. Bremerton, which, again, I've mentioned before in this course, and it really is a fundamental shift. And I don't know that I can make that tremendously clear as in how big of a change this constituted, but Kennedy presents a pretty fundamental question. Let's say the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause are in conflict with one another, as it was in this case. Kennedy is a school employee, a public school employee, which means he's an employee of the government, but he is clearly engaging in prayer. During the process of completing a football competition, and as a football coach's daughter, I can assure you this would be considered within, let's say, the standard job duties of the coach. By that, I mean that the coach has to be present on the field to help ensure management of the team, orderliness of the competition. In essence, you're the coach and you're there to ensure that the game gets carried out in a way that is respecting both the expectations of the competition and ensuring the safety of the students, right? As well as hopefully their effective participation in that activity. Again, I've lived this a lot in my personal life, just as the daughter of a coach. So a lot is going to be expected around coaches as far as their behavior throughout the time of the competition, both before the game and after. And what you can see in the pictures is that Coach Kennedy is engaging in prayer in the context of the post-game scenario, right? The game is over. A lot of times there are individuals who are from his team as well as potentially the opposing team, and they appear to be engaging in prayer. And not in a kind of separate prayer, but prayer at midfield, which is being recorded and observed by several different press entities. These are the photos that you see listed on slide 28. There are a ton of case facts in this case, and so I'd encourage you to actually go and, again, read the syllabus, but read through what the case facts are as presented in the majority decision, as well as in the dissenting opinion, because there are some pretty big differences in the way the justices are understanding what is going on. Now, the Oyez summary is on slides 29 and 30. 29 covers some of the basic facts that I believe most sides agree upon, but again, there is a lot that's missing here that we don't get the full picture of the story and maybe don't fully see exactly how the school approached everything and how Kennedy approached everything. Now, I've said before, or at least if I haven't in these podcasts, I want to highlight, it's often the case that the Supreme Court doesn't overly emphasize the case facts in any one case, but I do think here that they talk quite a bit about it in the majority opinion and in the dissenting opinion. So go ahead and read through those if you have time, and then look over what is listed on slide 30 for the Oyez summary of the majority opinion, where they're considering both free exercise and free speech. And I want you to consider, how does this work in relation to thinking about the boundaries we've established with the Establishment Clause. At the conclusion of the Kennedy v. Bremerton case, we end up with a pretty profound decision which says, okay, we no longer have the Lemon Test, which applied to the Establishment Clause, and instead we have a new test that looks at historical practices and understandings. You'll notice I mentioned this when I talked about Establishment Clause tests because, seeing it this way, we have the same basic test for both free exercise and Establishment Clause. And as I noted before, that leaves a lot open. Which historical practices are we going to be looking at? Which understandings? Does historical practices mean we're including precedent here? So if we had precedent being considered, does West Virginia v. Barnett give us a clear indication? Or maybe something more like, I don't know, thinking about Wallace v. Jaffrey and things like moments of silence. How do these precedents fit into our history and tradition or the practices and understandings we've had? On a final note with this case, I want you to read that last line from Oye. Applying that test, the one about historical practices and understandings, there is no conflict between the constitutional commands of the First Amendment in this case. Do you agree? Do you feel like the history clearly points in one direction or the other? And if it does, do you find yourself in the same place as the Supreme Court? Or do you find yourself in a different place? There's no right answer to that question. I just really want to encourage you to think critically through all of the options and to both identify where you may disagree with the majority as well as agree with the majority. Or in looking at the case, again, where do you come down in terms of the dissenting opinion? And how does that align with your view of historical practices and understandings? On that final note, we are done covering the major Establishment Clause and Free Exercise Clause cases. There are quite a few other additional important cases that I would highlight for you that have touched on both of those clauses or one of them. A big one that comes out of the state of Nebraska, which actually is kind of the, let's say, historical lead-in to the current test we have, is from 1983 with Marsh v. Chambers. Ernie Chambers was one of the longest-serving state senators in the state of Nebraska, and he filed a suit related to prayer at the beginning of each Nebraska legislative session. And in the decision of that case, they actually said back then the Lemon Test was abandoned, and there's this recognition that there's this history and tradition, and it's a custom embraced way, way back. So you get historical practices starting to be discussed all the way back in 1983. Note the dissent there as well, where they're saying, you didn't even try to do the test that we've created and was just decided in 1971. We're only 12 years down the road from that case. Why aren't we applying that test here? We really need to think about how does this test conflict with what the majority is offering, and what does precedent mean if we are going to overthrow the test in the face of looking at, again, customs and practices? Some additional interesting cases are listed on the final slide, 33, and what I've done there is just list the case title and the citation, the main question that came up, and the general decision of the court. Some very interesting cases thrown in there. I think we've got some stuff that looks toward, you know, that evolution, particularly on Establishment Clause. I'm thinking, look at Van Orden v. Perry in 2005. And as far as things like responses to some of the cases we read about, Employment Division v. Smith is followed by a case called Gonzalez v. Ocentro Espirita Beneficiente Unao de Vegetal. I said probably most of that wrong, but it's the last listing under the Free Exercise Clause cases where what Congress did after Employment Division v. Smith was pass the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, basically intended to cover the kinds of situations that were encountered under Employment Division v. Smith. And then we need to look at, well, what did they decide in 2006 versus what they decided in 1990? All right. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen through this quite long episode. I realize that these are pretty lengthy, but all conversations when it comes to the fundamental rights will be. So we'll be looking at about an hour long for each podcast episode from here on out. When and if you have questions, of course, email me and I will get back to you as soon as I can. Okay, have a wonderful rest of your day, night, week, weekend, wherever you're at, and I will connect with you again soon.